Now, if history repeats itself, one of the most popular things on TV tomorrow will be a looped 7-minute piece of film that's over 40 years old. It's consistently in the top 3 programs on Christmas morning in some cities, and yet it has no plot, no actors, and it's played for hours at a time. It's the WPIX Yule Log. It's a New York City tradition that now airs across the country. And although it's kitschy to some, it holds a special place in the hearts of many. And as NPR's Siri Grassley reports, the original log has helped spawn a quirky genre of film that's finding new popularity on high-definition televisions.
It's Christmas Eve, a wonderful time for family and friends.
The original televised Yule Log made its debut 45 years ago this Christmas.
The WPIX Yule Log, 2 commercial-free hours.
The program was an immediate hit with New Yorkers, many of whom didn't have a fireplace. Lawrence R. Curie vividly remembers the first time he saw the Yule Log. It was 1972, and his family had just moved to New Jersey.
So we have the fireplace on one side of the family room blazing away in full color and vigor. And then on the other side of the family room, the TV would be blazing away with the Yule Log. And we probably watched the TV more than we did the real fireplace.
R. Curie was enchanted. Since then, he's become one of the Yule Log's biggest supporters. He started a fan website for it and even helped create a new hour of the program in 2006. R. Curie says the Yule Log has always signaled a moment of peaceful reflection for him.
Everything stopped. You knew that when the Yule Log was on, it was time to relax, you know, put the gifts down, stop wrapping, stop the baking, stop whatever you were into, and just enjoy the solemnity of the moment.
The WPIX Yule Log has become a cult hit, but it's never been released on DVD. And R. Curie says it probably won't because of the cost of licensing the iconic Christmas music used in its soundtrack. But even though the genuine Yule Log isn't on DVD, today there are dozens of generic fireplace movies on the market. And as it turns out, filming a fireplace well can be harder than it sounds.
I thought, you know, I would just put a fire together like I did in Boy Scouts and create this ultimate fire.
That's George Ford, the owner of Fireplace for Your Home, a production company in Longview, Washington.
Well, when I set up the camera equipment and the lighting, the first fire just didn't kind of burn right.
He spent over a year trying to perfect it and made more than 30 fires. Each time, he changed an element, like the lighting, log setup, and, yes, the type of wood.
In fact, some of that would be our trade secret. Not too much sap, just enough sap, a little bit of bark, not too much bark. The bark tends to smoke a little bit. The sap tends to snap and crack.
Ford filmed his movie with high-definition televisions in mind, and he's released Blu-ray and 3D versions. He says the end result is so realistic, some customers swear they can feel heat radiating from the TV. And he says sales have been overwhelming. It's all part of the growing popularity of a film genre known as ambient video.
Sometimes I bill myself as the leading academic expert on ambient video.
Jim Bezoki is a professor in the School of Interactive Arts and Technology at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver.
The reason I can do that is I suspect I'm the only one.
Bezoki first started thinking about ambient video over 10 years ago when flat-screen TVs were entering the market.
There's a well-understood phenomenon that a lot of people have consistently left their televisions on. And I thought, well, I suspect artists are going to start making video material much like living photographs that people can hang on these flat panel displays and look at when they're not watching television and they're not watching home theater.
Bezoki says he realized the fireplace version of ambient video was becoming more popular last year when he checked in on cable listings for Yule Logs. On Christmas Eve, there were 20 different options. Just 4 years ago, there were only 4. But if you're cynical about people replacing the real thing with a televised version, Bezoki has a message for you.
Bah humbug. The logic of ambient video is this. I go about my life, and if there's a lull, if for a few minutes I don't know what exactly I want to do, I look at something beautiful, and then, you know, then I go back to my life.
It's actually one of Bezoki's favorite party tricks. He's used his own fireplace to make his own video, and on Christmas he plans to play it on a TV, hidden in the hearth. For NPR News, I'm Siri Grassley.
Two.
$2,000 for the electricity bill. Wow. Well, it's probably fair to say that Bill Cosby does not go out of his way to hang elaborate Christmas decorations from his house in western Massachusetts. But every Christmas, his three young grandchildren come for a visit. And last year, Cosby used his connections to get a personal phone call from some of Santa's helpers. He writes about what happened in his new book. It's called I Didn't Ask to Be Born, But I'm Glad I Was. And when I spoke with Cosby this past week, I asked him to describe what his grandkids are like.
They're annoying. I am not the kind of grandfather who really believes that they came from heaven above. I mean, these people make a lot of noise. They blame each other for things. They take turns. It's almost like, okay, 1, 2, 3, and you go in that order, screaming and yelling.
One is age 7.
Seven, and then 2 were 8.
8, okay. So this is a cold Christmas Eve. The kids are not behaving. So you come up with this ingenious plan to get them to cooperate and behave, and the phone rings. And who's on the phone?
It was an assistant to Mr. and Mrs. Claus. And the assistant found that the three grandchildren were not where they're supposed to be. And she had these letters with the requests for presents and the names, and she was checking to see if these were the presents for these children, if these were the children. She called in on my phone, and at first I thought it was Rita Moreno, but it wasn't. It was the assistant
to Santa Claus.
Yeah, and said, are they there? So I said, yes, just a minute. So I walked into the den of iniquity and yelling. And I said to them, there's an assistant of Santa Claus's on the phone who wants to talk to you guys. And automatically, man,
that's it.
They turned around and looked at me. And I said, come on. And they walked. They looked, reminded me of the Ritz brothers. It was three brothers, a comedy team, and they were stuck together. And they were walking, and came, and I put the assistant on the speakerphone, and the assistant went up and down the list.
The children, of course, I'm assuming, were declaring how good they'd been throughout the year.
Like pro quarterbacks who are taught, you know, forget that last interception.
Now, Mrs. Jones, who was Santa's assistant, she actually, at a certain point, she tells the kids that she's getting another call and that there's somebody else on the line.
Is Skylar.
And Skylar is?
Santa doesn't know where he's going. You know, in the day of computers and things like that, the kids are not where they're supposed to be. Skylar's job is to make the corrections.
Skylar is basically Santa's navigator.
Exactly. And Skylar asked where they were. So we're at Grandpappy and Grandmommy's house. Well, where are they? You know, they really couldn't say because they're always brought to the house.
They didn't know where they were. I mean, they knew they were in Massachusetts.
Yeah, but they couldn't tell anybody how to get there. One description was, well, you get off the plane, then you get in the car, and then when you wake up, you'll be in Greenfield. And he told them he could see them if they went outside and pointed to a certain star.
So you send all three grandchildren outside?
No, I did not.
You didn't? I see. Okay.
No, please. We're on the radio. I don't want people to think Bill Cosby sent his grandchildren
I see.
Out.
Forgive me. Santa's navigator.
It was about 30 degrees below zero. So, but see, these greedy children, that's who we can blame it on. The greed of little children said, okay, go outside. And they were pointing, and all three of them pointed in different directions. And then all I heard Skylar was saying on the phone, which was a speaker, okay, I have it. I know where they are now. So they were called back in.
They came back in, and there was one more phone call. Phone rings again. This is an important call.
This is from an assistant who is, and I didn't know, anything about this was Santa's dietitian.
See.
So I said, just a minute, and I put it to the speaker, and I went back to the den of iniquity and yelling and screaming, which they were doing again. And I said, there's another assistant. So here they come. And he, in fact, said to them, please do not leave any cookies or milk.
Wow.
For Santa, because his cholesterol and the triglycerides way up there, which one can see and on pictures of him.
He cannot actually eat the cookies and drink the milk.
No. You could leave out maybe some soy milk.
Oh.
But not 2% plain. No silk.
No silk.
No silk. No chocolate flavored. You know, none of that stuff. Just water.
Or plain soy milk.
Please.
Are the grandkids coming for Christmas this year? Are they with you this year?
They will be here.
So are you planning to arrange for some phone calls for them this year?
I don't think they're going to go for it.
Uh-oh.
This time.
That's Bill Cosby. His new book is called I Didn't Ask to Be Born, But I'm Glad I Was. Bill Cosby, thank you so much, and Merry Christmas to you.
And to all grandparents who smile because they see a grandchild.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto. If you haven't seen the TV show Breaking Bad, get it on your Netflix queue, because at the center of the action is Walter White. He's the show's chemistry teacher turned meth maker turned anti-hero. This month, the Associated Press, Entertainment Weekly, even NPR's Fresh Air named the show as one of the top 10 TV shows of 2011. The show's fourth season just ended, and if you haven't seen it, you'll have a couple of months to catch up before the last season, season 5, gets started. And if you have seen the show, you know a bit about science. You've probably been pleasantly surprised about how accurate the science is. Well, that is no accident. Joining me now to talk more about it is the show's science advisor, Donna Nelson, in her day job as a professor of organic chemistry at the University of Oklahoma in Norman. She joins us from there. Welcome to Science Friday.
Oh, thank you so much. It's a real pleasure to be here.
How did you get such a good job like that?
Oh, it's just been amazingly fun. I'm a member of the American Chemical Society, and in its magazine, The Chemical and Engineering News, there was an interview of Vince Gilligan when he had first started the television show Breaking Bad. And in that interview, he was stating how important it was to him that he get the science right for the show. But he talked about how he didn't have that much of a science background, and none of his writers had an extensive science background, and so they were having to go to the web and Wikipedia in order to get science content. And he made a statement in that article that he would welcome constructive criticism from knowledgeable sources. And in looking at that, I realized it was organic chemistry, and I've been
here. That's it.
This is all I've ever done is teach organic chemistry, and I thought, I can do that.
You can do
so
that.
I volunteered.
That's great. Let's play a clip from the show so people get a little bit of flavor, if they haven't seen Breaking Bad, about what's happening there. So let me cue that up now.
Monoalkenes, diolefins, trienes, polyenes. I mean, the nomenclature alone is enough to make your head spin. But when you start to feel overwhelmed, and you will, just keep in mind that one element, carbon. Carbon is at the center of it all. There is no life without carbon.
Now that is the teacher, the character Walter White, played by?
Yes, by Bryan Cranston.
Bryan Cranston. And that is sort of a tame part of the program, where he's actually teaching chemistry to the class there, right?
Yes, that was one of the scenes in which he was actually teaching organic chemistry to the high schoolers. And that scene is very interesting, at least to me, because they appealed to me and said, you know, we want to teach, We want to present him teaching about alkenes to these high school students, what would be appropriate for him to say, and they had written a few things, and there were, you know, some errors, and I mean, that's, you know, really basic organic chemistry. And so I just wrote them back a little bit about the nomenclature of alkenes and, you know, tried to fill them in a little bit. And a lot of what I said was used in that very introduction. It was really amusing to see them, you know, use the material. And at the end of that, they had said, well, is there anything that he would have written on the blackboard? And so I drew out some structures and sent them to them by email. And I was just amazed they drew up on the blackboard exactly what I had sent them.
Mm-hmm. Of course, this is a chemistry teacher who finds out that he can make a lot more money making methamphetamines using his chemistry knowledge than he can teaching school.
Yes, so he's a very good organic chemistry and organic chemist. He's an excellent organic chemist, and so he makes excellent meth. And I'm always very fast to say that that is not what we do in our labs at the at the University of Oklahoma.
Does he ever,
or in any of our classrooms?
Are you ever fearful that he'll give away the recipe, the real way? Does he ever give away the real way to chemically make meth in a lab on the show?
Oh, do they do that?
Yes.
Are you asking
do
that?
They, yes.
No, they don't. That was actually one of the concerns of a lot of people, but. Vince Gilligan has been very clever. You know, there are multiple ways to make meth, and so although his scenes are very accurate, he will sort of kludge together parts of different syntheses, so that if you just simply followed the one synthesis as it's presented, you wouldn't come out with methamphetamine.
Yeah, I've got another cut I want to play here that sort of gives a little bit more of the flavor of the show when on the darker side.
Okay.
They use reductive amination to yield methamphetamine, 4 pounds.
So no pseudo?
No pseudo.
So you do have a plan. Yeah, Mr. White. Yes, science.
That's what one of his drug dealers telling him that he's very happy to know science because it's making him a lot of money.
Yeah. And so, you know, it's a very unusual show. And when this first... came about, and I had to decide whether I wanted to, you know, try to assist them. Originally, I was thinking, well, you know, would I want to get involved in something like this? And then after watching a few episodes of the show, I realized this is not glorifying drug making at all, because he has a very hard life, you know. I mean, starting out, he was in his underwear in the desert and, you know, the sand and getting scraped up, and then later he gets, you know, beat up and shot at and all sorts of fights, and I can't imagine somebody looking at that and saying, yes, that's exactly the type of life I want to lead. So I thought, well, you know, they're going to either have a hit show with good science portrayed or with bad science portrayed. And, of course, for scientists, when we see science portrayed badly, you know, inaccurately on television or in the movies, it's like fingernails on the blackboard. So I thought, well, you know, I'll help them. And, of course, I can't help them on the illicit meth scenes, the illicit meth lab scenes, but they get assistance from the DEA.
Yeah.
I'm not their only science advisor. They have many advisors, and I think I might have been the only one on the high school chemistry scenes, but they have many DEA agents helping them.
Let's go to a call from Mitchell in Chicago. Hi, Mitch. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira.
Hi.
I love Science Friday.
Thank you. Got a question for us?
Yeah, actually, I wanted to say I've always been interested in chemistry ever since I was little. But when I started watching this show, I decided to go back to college to study chemistry.
Wow! So that was an impetus, a catalyst, as they would say in chemistry.
Yeah, catalyst.
That's actually wonderful. That's absolutely wonderful. I think that Vince Gilligan would be thrilled to know that his show is having that sort of an influence.
Thanks.
Yep, I can't wait for the next season. It's not coming soon enough.
That's the last one.
Thank you.
Yep.
Thanks, Mitch.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling. Is he really concerned? The producer is he really concerned about, you know, encouraging people to learn about chemistry on each episode? Does he have a little bit of real chemistry on it, or has that sort of gone away?
I think so. Yes, he really does, and he was very concerned about getting the science right. He was. I was really delighted to see this in him because, you know, for so long there's been this sort of a myth that you can't portray good science or accurate science and actually have an interesting show. And I think that this show proves that that is a myth. It is entirely possible to present science accurately and have a hit show. And I really hope that what he's done, and of course this has been done by other television shows, you know, CSI, et cetera.
Big Bang Theory.
But I hope that it will inspire others to follow his example.
So you must be sad to see it going into its last season then.
Yes, you know, it's been a wonderful show, but I really do believe that others will pick up where he's left off in this one aspect.
Do you believe that science is having sort of a rebirth on in the entertainment industry, on television, perhaps in the movies, with science movies and TV shows coming out?
Yeah, I think it perhaps is. I know that many of the scientists are trying to become more available now as science advisors, and the National Science Foundation is really trying hard to further this. And, you know, there have been even discussions in Congress about what we need is a hit television show that portrays good science. And that's been said for a long time. And, of course, like I mentioned, there are many shows that already fill that, such as CSI. But this is the first time that we've had one, I believe, on organic chemistry per se.
I would have never thunk it myself, having done so terribly in chemistry in my own lifetime, that a kid show would have been based around organic chemistry.
Yeah. Well, I say that, you know, it's a lifetime goal trying to teach organic chemistry to make it easy. And I'm starting to wonder if I'm ever going to achieve it in my lifetime.
His teaching,
but we do try.
Do you use the same teaching methods that he does in the front of that classroom?
No, not really. Of course, I'm teaching at the graduate level, and,
right,
and the chemistry that I'm teaching is more difficult. I'm teaching undergraduate and graduate both, but it's a little more advanced than what he gets into. His is really sort of a lower level, and when you get more to the higher levels, you have to teach more pattern recognition. It can't possibly be just straight memorization. I think the key to making it easier is the pattern recognition and, you know, relating just simple rules,
right,
to be able to absorb the mass amount of material and draw patterns across the material. That's what will make it easier.
And what it makes this show interesting to viewers, I guess, is that it deals with the drug world, which a lot of people know a lot about, but it uses that as, so to speak, the catalyst to talk about the science itself.
Because yeah, I think that much of the science is so spectacular that, to me, it seemed to almost become a separate character in the show. And when I mentioned that to Vince, he said yes, that he thought that was the case. And so I don't know if he actually intended that from the beginning, but that's the way it's worked out, and I think it's wonderful.
So people would expect, like, a character to show up every week, right? You tune in to see what he might be talking about, what the science might be in that episode.
Yeah, a different type of science or a different little take on science or, you know, something interesting about science.
Yeah, just
I think it's been wonderful. It was just so much fun participating in this. I had a terrific time, and I would strongly recommend other scientists who are considering doing this to go ahead. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, well, we'll see what happens. And do you know what happens in the fifth season yet?
No, I don't. And even if I did, I wouldn't be able to tell you.
Just between us. Thank you. And good luck to you. And maybe we'll see you on another TV series soon. Never know.
Oh, well, thanks. I mean, I would love it. It's been a terrific amount of fun. I've really enjoyed it.
Thank you very much, Dr. Nelson.
Thank you.
Donna Nelson, in her day job, is a professor of organic chemistry at the University of Oklahoma in Norman, and she joined us from Norman. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the annual Christmas bird count and all kinds of stuff having to do with birds. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break.
A few strings of lights and an inflatable Santa are enough for some people when it comes to holiday decorations, but not for the Garabedian family of the Bronx. Their over-the-top Christmas displays have been a traffic-snarling must-see for nearly four decades. And as George Bedarkey from member station WFUV reports, Traditional is most definitely not the right word for this holiday attraction.
The first giveaway might be the music the Garabedians play through speakers outside their home. Instead of a Christmas carol, you're more likely to hear a hit single from a singer like Engelbert Humperdinck. A long line of cars slowly cruise past the family's two-story house in this ordinarily quiet residential neighborhood. And while you will find Dasher, Dancer, and the rest of Santa's reindeer crew up on the second-story deck, the Garabedians' massive holiday display also features life-size figures of other notables, generally not associated with Christmas.
Joan Collins, Elizabeth Taylor, Mal Monroe, Nicole Kidman, there's Cher, there's Dinah Ross, there's Michael Jackson.
That's Gary Garabedian. His mom started the tradition of decorating the house in 1973 as a way to give back to the community. Gary was 9 at the time. He says it started off small with just a few dolls. Now they have more than 150 mannequins. Many are robotic. Some simply move their heads or hands. Others play instruments.
Some are dancing the waltz. Beauty and the Beast is doing the whole waltz. We have chandeliers that are spinning.
There's even a Liberace-like mannequin playing a realistic-looking Steinway piano. The Garabedians make the fiberglass mannequins themselves. The family's in the dressmaking business, so they also outfit the mannequins in fashions you might see on the red carpet.
It's so over the top. It's kind of like it's so bad, it's good. I think it's just great.
Paul Laurie traveled from Bell Harbor, Queens, about a 40-minute drive, to take in the display's elaborateness.
Oh, my goodness. This is just fabulous, fabulous.
Connie Hardy lives on the other side of the Bronx. She came to see the house with her family and best friend. She says it makes her feel like a kid again.
I can do this every day. Come and see this every day. Everything that you imagine to life, you know? And it's just so great.
This was Hardy's first time here, but for a lot of people, it's a holiday tradition. Damaris Rios has been coming for 20 years.
I love this house. This is awesome. Every year is different.
Alvin and the Chipmunks made their debut this year. Next year, Elvis will take the stage for the first time. Gary Garabedian says the display took on a celebrity theme a few years ago.
It's a celebration. When somebody's born a birthday, it's a celebration. So Christmas is a birthday. All the movie stars come together to celebrate Christ's birth.
A giant nativity scene overlooks the entire display. Gary says more than 50 500-watt halogen spotlights light up the whole thing. Their electricity bill runs about $2,000 for the season. But Gary says it's worth it because of the smiles it puts on people's faces. As for the neighbors annoyed by all of the traffic on their block, Gary says he encourages them to just bear with it. For NPR News, I'm George Bodarkey in New York.